Not everyone is excited about NASA's mission, and count our commentator Andrei Kudrescu among the distraught. To him, what NASA crashed into the moon is just one more humiliation for our heavenly neighbor, one more in a long line of indignities.
Landing a man on the moon to do it before the Russians was crazy enough. The value was purely symbolic, and as far as symbolism goes, the moon has it all over nationalism. The moon's been a symbol since humanity began. She is Luna, who gave us the name for the months of the year, the faithful and lonely companion of Earth, who lives in our oldest poems and crosses the sky of our dreams. She pulls up the tides and the blood in the bodies of women. She is the archetype who is always on the verge of stereotype, but never gets there, because no matter how many bad songs and broken hearts she uses up, she is still just as powerful when you look up and see her in the sky, growing full and sickle thin. She works her poetic charms in English, Russian, German, and every other language, the supreme metaphor. So how much does a metaphor weigh? A lot more than NASA thinks. The first man on the moon wasn't an American or a Russian. It was the man in the moon we all saw when we were kids and somebody older showed him to us. That's the first man on the moon, her permanent resident, and now he's got a NASA rocket at his backside. Who does the moon belong to, anyway? Can we just blow a hole in it without asking all the billions of people on Earth who look up at the sky every night and wonder at her beauty and talk about it? They used to call the mentally ill lunatics, but now I wonder who the real lunatics are. And if there is water on the moon, what are we going to do with it? Grow moon corn for ethanol until we kill the Earth?
That's our contrarian and lunar lover, Andrei Kudrescu. He publishes the online journal Corpse.org.
Oren Peli's horror film, Paranormal Activity, cost $15,000 to make and features unknown actors. After festival screenings, it was picked up by Paramount Pictures for national distribution. The studio mounted a campaign to build word of mouth with midnight shows across the country. Those were sold out. Now it's expanding to many cities, and you can see it anytime. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
As the Blair Witch Project prove, nothing is scarier than nothing. Forget monsters, vampires. Think of darkness and the crack of a twig nearby. You freeze. You wait. It's the waiting that makes Paranormal Activity nearly unbearable, even if, like me, you love to be scared. When something on screen actually happens, it's like any other dumb horror picture. It's very conventional in the light of day. But, of course, we're not seeing things by the light of day. As in Blair Witch, the perspective is radically limited. There's no omniscient point of view. We watch everything through the video camera of Mika, a day trader played by Mika Sloat. He comes home to his suburban San Diego house with his new toy after his live-in girlfriend Katie, played by Katie Featherston, reports noises in the night. An alien presence.
High def camera on. My girlfriend Katie, she thinks there's something in the house. I don't know.
You believe me, right?
I think we're going to have a very interesting time capturing whatever paranormal phenomena is occurring or is not occurring.
Here's the scariest part. Director Oren Peli's genius gimmick. Mika sets up the camera to record when they sleep. The view is of their bed and the door and the dark hall leading to the stairway. The image is pale, greenish and white. There's a timer on the screen. You see 1:32 a.m. and 40 seconds, 41, 42, 43, and then there's a low rumble. On some nights, there might be a faint sound of walking or running. Often Katie and Mika don't wake up, although they watch the footage the next day on a computer. But sometimes there's a thud or a crash, and Mika grabs the camera and walks into the hall, a little orb of light illuminating a corner, a railing, or pointing down the stairs into the darkness. A psychic, played by Mark Fredericks, specializes in ghosts, which he says are ex-humans, whereas this is likely a demon, non-human, evil. He gives them the phone number of a demonologist. Katie wants to call, but Mika doesn't. He's a macho man. He yells things into the darkness like, "Is that all you got?" After a while, the audience decides he's a moron. We think, "Call the demonologist, Katie, please." Paranormal Activity is weakest when it's most explicit, which increasingly it is. Even a recognizable shadow, or a door swinging shut, or bed covers rising up, dilute the dread. This is not a great ghost story on the order of The Innocents or the original The Haunting. It's not even as irrationally terrifying as The Blair Witch Project. But Pelly is very shrewd in how he uses the microscopic budget and single setting to make us feel trapped and to exploit our anticipation. Every time he cut to another night and the timer appeared, I said out loud, "Oh, God, here we go," as well as words I can't say on the radio. Lights click on and off. Katie gets out of bed and stands, just stands by the side of the bed, as the timer runs in fast motion to show she hasn't budged for an hour. Is she awake? Is something holding her? Throughout this movie, something sure as hell is holding us.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. There's a classic silent film that shows a rocket zooming toward the man in the moon. It hits him smack in the eye. That was early science fiction. Well, this morning, NASA did something a little bit like that. It smashed an empty rocket into a cold, dark lunar crater near the moon's south pole. The goal was to kick up evidence of water in the form of ice, as NPR's Neil Greenfield Boyce reports.
Moments before, the big rocket part crashed into a lunar crater at more than 5,000 miles per hour. Flight director Rusty Hunt asked his team at NASA's Ames Research Center in California if they were ready for the impact.
Payloader, you go. Go flight. Science.
Go.
As the chunk of rocket hurtled down towards the lunar surface, another spacecraft followed. Its cameras and science instruments were sending images and data back to Earth. NASA showed this footage live on the internet. You could see gray craters slowly coming closer and closer until the big target crater, Cabeus, filled the screen with black shadows hiding its floor.
All stations flight. Mark Centaur impact.
But when the rocket hit, the footage didn't show a big explosion. The images just got fuzzy and disappeared. As planned, the observation spacecraft had crashed a few minutes after the first impact. All around the country, people had gathered to watch NASA sock it to the moon. At the museum in Washington, D.C., NASA officials and people off the street viewed the footage on a big screen. John Glowacki of McLean, Virginia, had come with his daughter and young son, who was wearing a spacesuit costume. Glowacki said the crash didn't look quite like he expected.
I was waiting for the plume, actually, but I guess that comes later. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
The impact was expected to send a huge cloud of debris miles up above the crater's rim, but initial images didn't show that. At a press conference, mission managers said maybe the plume just didn't rise as high as they expected or was at an angle.
I guess I'm not necessarily surprised because I knew I would be surprised, if that makes any sense. I knew we were going someplace that to expect what you're not going to expect.
Anthony Colapriet is the project scientist for this mission, which is called LCROSS, for Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. His team said images were still being processed from the spacecraft and telescopes that were watching the crash. We'll be putting the latest pictures up at NPR.org. Colapriet says they already know enough to say the mission was successful.
I can certainly report there was an impact. We saw the impact. We saw the crater. And we got good measurements, spectroscopic measurements, which is what we needed, of the impact event.
He says it looks like they'll have the data they need to answer the question, is water hidden inside the moon's darkest, coldest craters? He said it'll be a while before they make any announcements, but reporters pressed Colapriet to say if any early signs of water had been found. One reporter asked if he would know if water is there later in the day.
I probably will, but I'm not going to tell you.
He says his team has to study the new information thoroughly.
We just got to sit back and be careful. We don't want to, again, life is full of surprises. We want to be careful, not make a false negative or a false positive claim?
Knowing if water is in the craters, and if so, how much, would be scientifically interesting as well as potentially useful as NASA plans future exploration efforts. Kolapreet said his team would be working feverishly, but first, they were going to get some sleep. They'd been up all night, getting ready for their brief 1-2 punch to the moon. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
As we've often heard, there are 46 million people in the U.S. without health insurance. But more than 200 million have no insurance to cover long-term health care. That includes nursing homes, assisted living centers, home care, and other assistance that almost all of us need when we get old. Some proposals to help have quietly made their way into the health care overhaul bills. But as NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports, there is a dispute over the cost.
Donna Taylor's father was the rock of the family. He was the primary caregiver for his disabled wife and her elderly mother. But he got sick and went into the hospital for 10 days. When he got out, he couldn't walk. With three elderly disabled adults in one house, caregiving got expensive. Donna Taylor says her father was surprised at how quickly the family went through its savings.
He said, "I worked and I did the right things. I had a pension and I put money away in savings and I had what I thought were the right insurances, and the money didn't go far enough. It just wasn't enough."
Like most Americans, Taylor's parents believe that their health insurance would pay all the costs of living in a nursing home. It doesn't. But Medicaid does. That's the state and federal insurance for the poor. So Taylor told her father he'd have to spend through the rest of his savings and go into poverty.
"If you have ever had to look in the eyes of a 64-year-old man who's now had to go live in a nursing home, and it's horrible. And he never, ever made me feel bad about that decision. He never said, 'Donna, why'd you do this to me?' But he told me this isn't how it was supposed to work out."
Donna Taylor's father died in that Phoenix nursing home last year. She thinks he sort of gave up on life. John Rother of the AARP says proposals written into health care overhaul legislation would help families like Donna Taylor's. One would encourage states to offer more generous benefits to disabled and elderly people on Medicaid who want to stay in their own homes. And then, says Rother, there's something that could help millions of people.
"The CLASS Act, which was introduced by the late Senator Ted Kennedy, is a way of putting into place gradually an insurance approach to long-term care as opposed to the welfare-based approach we have today.
Workers would choose whether to have money deducted from their paychecks. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that deduction would, on average, come to about $65 a month. And when needed, it would pay about $75 a day. That's a little less than half of what one day in a nursing home costs now." John Rother.
"The CLASS Act is not designed to protect people from the cost of nursing home care, very expensive care. It's really designed to help you stay independent at home and to get the services you need, home care, Meals on Wheels, visiting nurse, the kind of thing that people do need very often to be able to continue to live independently. And, you know, I think that's actually what most of us want."
So how much is this thing going to cost? That's the dispute. The way it's written, it's supposed to pay for itself. How much gets paid out depends on how much is collected from those voluntary payroll deductions. Frank Keating is president of the American Council of Life Insurers.
"It sounds good in principle, but it is a huge unfunded liability."
The Congressional Budget Office says the CLASS plan would reduce the federal deficit by $58 billion over 10 years. That's why it's got a good chance of ending up in final legislation. But Keating says the numbers are wishful thinking, that those savings come in the early years when the money's being collected, and that it's going to cost trillions of dollars when people start needing the benefits. Keating represents companies that sell private long-term care insurance. Less than 10% of older people have bought one of those private policies. It's been a hard sell. Still, Keating argues it'll be even harder to get young people to buy into the proposed public plan.
"It assumes young people will purchase this insurance from the government for a need 40 years down the line. That simply isn't going to happen. Young people aren't going to have to do it unless they're mandated to do it, and they're not mandated to do it in this bill and should not be."
There hasn't been a lot of high-profile debate about the proposal to add long-term care to health overhaul. And that reflects the way Americans tend to think about getting old. It's something best not thought about at all. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Recently, the dollar has been tumbling while the price of gold has climbed. Officially, recent U.S. presidents and their advisors say a strong U.S. dollar is in the national interest. But as NPR's John Idsty reports, their rhetoric hasn't prevented the long slide in the dollar's value.
Back in March of 2008, before the financial crisis, the dollar was at historic lows against a basket of currencies. Then, when the financial storm struck, the dollar strengthened as investors rushed to the safety of U.S. Treasury securities. Now that the worst of the crisis appears to have passed, the dollar is sliding again. It's down more than 12% from its recent peak. Fred Bergsten of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says sentiment about the dollar has now turned negative.
Some private investors worry that the dollar may weaken systematically over time because of the big budget and trade deficits, so there's a search for alternatives to the dollar.
For some investors, the alternative is gold. For others, like some central banks around the world, the alternative is keeping more of their reserves in euros and yen. In fact, there's been renewed talk in some quarters of finding an alternative for the dollar as the world's major reserve currency. Bergsten says to counter the loss of confidence in the dollar, the Obama administration needs to take policy actions to shrink huge U.S. budget deficits, projected to be over $1 trillion a year for the next decade.
Social Security reform would be a perfect example, where you could decide to change the benefit formula, increase the retirement age. All that would phase in over a period of time. It would be sizable and credible, but it would not dampen the recovery from the recession.
Bergsten also thinks the U.S. economy will bounce back from the recession more quickly than expected, which could strengthen the dollar. Former Treasury official David Malpass, who now heads the firm Ensema Global, disagrees. He thinks the U.S. currency will continue to slide unless the Obama administration shifts the way the U.S. government talks about the dollar.
You'd get quite a bit of change, upward movement, and more prosperity for Americans, more capital flowing into the United States, if the president would say he'd like the dollar to be stronger.
Malpass says the current administration line, which is a strong dollar is in the national interest, has lost its meaning. He says while that's been the U.S. mantra for the last 15 years, the dollar has been sliding now for 8 years. He says some past U.S. administrations have been comfortable with a cheaper dollar because they think it makes the U.S. more competitive globally. Malpass argues that's not true.
The currency keeps getting weaker. Jobs keep moving overseas because that's where the capital is. Money wants to go to where it can get a steady return in real money, not in funny money. And in many ways, the dollar is becoming the funny money currency for the world. And that's not good for our competitiveness. That's not good for our living standards.
Malpass says the change in rhetoric about the dollar could have a positive effect immediately, even if it weren't backed up by big changes in U.S. policy.
There wouldn't need to be much backing. It would come as a shock. The markets would then fall into line and start strengthening the dollar.
Malpass argues that eventually the shift in rhetoric by the president would lead to changes in government policy that would support the goal. But it's safe to say the consensus is that rhetoric won't be enough, and that credible efforts to reduce deficits will be needed to restore confidence in the dollar. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.